And now, more tips with your host, Rebecca, on lifestyle improvement.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and it's not to be interpreted as medical advice. Hello, and welcome to our program, Lifestyle Improvement. This is your host, Rebecca. Today, we have the distinct pleasure of having with us Dr. Suzanne De La Monte. Dr. De La Monte is an associate professor of pathology and medicine in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine, Neuropathology, Neurology, and Neurosurgery at Brown University. She got her medical degree at Cornell University and has done work in several institutions, including the National Institute of Health, Johns Hopkins Hospital, Massachusetts General Hospital, and Harvard Medical School. Her main area of expertise include brain diabetes and neurodegeneration, particularly Alzheimer's disease. She's also been involved with studies on insulin resistance, metabolic dysfunction, and the brain. She has published over 250 original articles, and we're very thankful that she's joining us via Skype all the way from Rhode Island. Hello, Dr. De La Monte. How are you today? Thank you for coming to visit us.
I'm very well, thank you. It's a long week of work, but I'm very happy to be here.
I thank you so much for coming to be with us. I know how hard it was to get you to be here, so I know how busy you are.
Yes, it's, we're working very hard to come up with new ways for detecting and diagnosing and treating all these degenerative diseases. Because the market is fertile for doing something about the problem. And as people get older, we are increasing the population of people who have dementia. So that's a big problem.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. De La Monte, you came up with the term type 3 diabetes. What is that?
Well, it's a very interesting concept. Basically, if you know about diabetes, it's all about getting fuel to the cells. In diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2, the cells and the muscles and various parts of the body are starving. And they're starving because, for example, in type 1 diabetes, there's just not enough insulin. So the insulin knocks at the door normally, and it tells the cells, take up glucose so you can work and so you can make energy. But in type 1 diabetes, which is pretty much an autoimmune disease, in other words, it's an attack against the body itself, they don't make enough insulin. And so the cells starve, and the children, usually their children, they get very sick because they get weak and wasted. In type 2 diabetes, which is really epidemic today, it's a different problem. Usually they make even more than enough insulin. They make plenty of it. And the reason they make so much is that now the tissue, instead of not being able to take up sugar because they don't have any insulin, they just ignore the insulin. They are resistant to it. So all the information that comes from the body to say, please take up fuel, they're ignoring it. It's like knocking on the door. And the door has to be knocked on louder and louder and louder for the cells to say, oh, I should metabolize. Well, you can imagine these are two different causes of the brain or tissue starving. But in brain, we discovered this same exact process happens with neurodegeneration. So in human beings, they have a combination of not making enough insulin in the brain itself. And also, whatever insulin is there, the cells that need it ignore it. So because you have basically the same thing as type 1 plus type 2, we thought it would be very important to give it a name where people can recognize what's the basic problem. It's a diabetes type effect. And once you get that idea that there's a problem with energy metabolism, then the problem becomes you can manage it. You can find ways to get around it. If you just say the problem is amyloid, you look and you say, okay, now what? If you say, oh, the cells are dying, you say, okay, why? But if you have a way to say, you know what, the metabolism is messed up. And we've seen this before. We've seen this all over the place. It's an old disease. So why don't we look at what we already know and try to see if we can get the brain to respond to the same medications and treatments that work for the diabetes that we already know.
That's very well said. Now, you came up with this conclusion in a very accidental way, the connection between Alzheimer's and diabetes, correct?
Yes, it was very interesting again, because, you know, many of the people in the audience don't realize, but when we do science, we're not so clever and know all the answers from the get-go. And oftentimes we do experiments and we come across things by accident. And you can say, oh, accidents, you know, that's okay. But really the key thing is not just the accident, but knowing that the accident is important. And I would say probably the majority of things that are important are found by mistake. And the thing is that the people who find it realize, oh my goodness, this is important. So what were we doing? We were trying to make an animal model that's an experiment model in which we could knock out insulin in the brain. It was a deliberate attempt. And the reason was we were studying the effects of alcohol. Now, it turns out that alcohol is one of the many things that can cause tissue, including liver, muscle, to become insulin resistant, like a type 2 diabetes. In fact, they get diabetes as well. And we were trying to prove that if you took that away, you could make the same effect. And then also, if you treat it, you can reverse it. But we didn't want to make the whole body with this model. We just wanted to make the brain, because people who drink too much are demented. And what was interesting was, in the process of making these experiments, when I looked at the brain, I thought, oh my goodness, this is not what I was expecting. This is Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
And it was really like, wow, yeah. This is so important. That you have to stop everything you're doing, and I mean everything, and check it out, because the implications are crucial. You know, it's really, you are willing to look at something and say, I have seen this before. It's not what I was looking for, but if it's really right, I should check in the human. And that's what we did. And that's where the whole field took off. And I can assure you that the first time we mentioned this, it was not fun.
When what?
It was torture. But we stuck with it because we were sure.
And you did a lot of research to back this up, correct?
Yes, we had a lot of experiments. So many different versions of the experiments to show the same thing, looking at so many brains and looking at cerebral spinal fluid, which is hard to get, and basically showing that as the disease gets worse, so does the insulin resistance and the deficiency at the same time. And you can experimentally really block it completely if it's treated early enough. And I think there are lifestyle measures that we can use that can help people out quite a bit. What we don't know is when it actually begins. You know, we always look at patients when they start complaining or when someone complains about them. But supposing it begins when they're much, much younger. Supposing it's beginning when they're in their 20s, which is some possibility. But we don't see the effects of it until aging steps in. The Nunn study, this study is very important. It was done by a man, a researcher, his last name is Snowden, and I think he's written some books on it. And I would say these kinds of articles are crucial, because they teach you that something may be wrong with the brain a lot earlier than we're guessing. So he looked at the diaries of nuns, and the nuns live a kind of, I don't want to be insulting, but the lifestyle is not very interesting in terms of getting out and doing ordinary things. So they write diaries, and they kept pretty good records of how they were doing. Well, he analyzed the writings, and he found the women who wrote in a very clever way, a very gymnastic way, were preserved better than the ones who had the simple writing. And you can't help but to be struck that, wow, you're saying the whatever was wrong a long time ago. And maybe when you get older, you can protect it if you do something, but we don't know what that is necessarily. But it also says that maybe looking when people are 60 and 70 is too late.
Right.
And we should be working on some of these things at a lot earlier age, and working on protecting ourselves, because that's eventually what it will be.
This is your host, Rebecca, and now we will take a short break, and we will be right back with more ideas on lifestyle improvement.
A unique and specialized approach to spinal care is what you will find in the Advanced Spinal Care Clinic in Graham, Washington. Here's Dr. Craig Lipinski explaining why Nuka Care is unlike any other treatment.
Our goal is that we're making a specialized correction to the skull, the atlas, and the neck of each individual that is custom made or custom and specific created to get them healthy and then have them stay that way.
One of only 23 board certified Nuka practitioners in the world, Dr. Craig Lipinski offers you care that can significantly impact your health in positive ways.
This week we've seen somebody in here who's had a 50-point drop in blood pressure by having the skull, atlas, and neck corrected to a proper position.
To find out more about how Nuka Care can change your life, visit www.nuccawashington.com or call 253-445-8181.
Exactly, and if you have what sounds like you're saying that vulnerability already there.
Yes.
Then lifestyle definitely would make a difference as far
yes.
as how that develops. So the bottom line is that your brain cells are not able to take advantage of the glucose so that they're dying, correct?
Yeah. So glucose, everybody likes to put a bad rap for sugar, but you know, the brain is using almost always sugar. Mm-hmm. It can use some fatty acids, or we call them ketone bodies. So if you starve, and the audience may not know, but when people are starving, they actually can make other kinds of fuel, and the brain will use that too. And some people think that that fuel is very good for the brain. But so if you imagine these so-called ketone bodies and glucose, they're the main things that the brain will use. If you don't have those going to the brain will, you will lose brain cells. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of what we call regeneration. There's a lot of talk about it, but in point of fact, just look at the evidence. People who lose their brain cells lose them and they're not coming back. The people who are, I'm sure the audience knows, there are these people in the early to middle stages of Alzheimer's and degenerative diseases who one day they're great, another day they're awful. And, you know, they wax and wane, and it's very hard to, you know, you feel happy. Okay, one day they're listening to me, they seem to be all there, and the next day it's like they don't know your name. Mm-hmm. And what that says is, I think it means that there's hope at that stage because the neurons are functioning at some point. So we need to find a way to scrub the wires, as I like to say, and get them functioning every day.
Right.
And that's a very important concept. People shouldn't lose track of the fact that if you're working in one day and the next day you're not, you need to figure out what it is that what was that other day that made the person do well.
Exactly.
You know, imagine someone being getting weaker and weaker and weaker. Usually you see that don't get strong one day and lift, you know, 100, 200 pounds, and then the next day they can't lift anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually a progressive process. But in neurodegenerative diseases, there's a good chance that they have a lot of ability to make use of other pathways that mm-hmm. are not effectively used all of the time.
Right, right. And when you talk about neurodegenerative diseases, you're including not just Alzheimer's, but MS, diabetes, Parkinson's, autism, and ALS. I mean, it's a variety. I mean, the whole package, right?
Yes. I mean, I think the thing that one has to remember is that each one of these diseases, they start out with some kind of modest abnormality, and over time, they get worse. Mm-hmm. And it's this so-called progression that is the problem. So mm-hmm. it doesn't. If you have a stroke, for example, that's a lesion or abnormality, and then that sits there. Now you have a chance to get better a little bit from it, or maybe mm-hmm. entirely if it's small enough. But it's fixed, and so that's not degenerative. The degenerative diseases, they just keep chewing away at whatever is wrong, and they don't go back. And multiple sclerosis is a great example, but in that particular case, we happen to know that it's pretty much inflammatory driven, and it's an attack on your own brain cells, which is pretty much related to inflammation. But interestingly enough, they do progress, and they do end up with eventual impairment in cognition and function if they keep going forward. Fortunately, the pharmaceutical companies are doing a better job at coming up with treatments for this disease. I think it's pretty exciting what's going on in it. But if they don't work, that doesn't work for Alzheimer's, which mm-hmm. is not mm-hmm. not really. It has some inflammation, but it's not like multiple sclerosis at all. And autism, that we are still in the dark about that. It's a sad, sad disease, but depending upon how bad it is, some people can actually do pretty well in function if you isolate particular things that they can do over and over and over and do very well. I think that's a much more mysterious disease, but it's problematic because we've gone skyrocketing in rates. And whenever something changes over a period of 10 or 20 years, you know, maybe it's a gene template, but you know what? We didn't have it 30 years ago like this. So this is something we have done, and we need to know what we did to ourselves to get there. But at the same time, I think of, well, if we've done it, doesn't that mean we can turn it back?
Exactly.
Doesn't that mean we can go the other way? So I feel horrible that somehow we've done something awful to our society and people, but I also feel hopeful that if we chase it down, mm-hmm. we'll be able to go back to the low levels we had before.
Well, I was seeing one of your presentations where you actually showed some of the graphs and how from the 1980s, it was just a spike that was just incredible. And it really does make you wonder and think what changed during that time to make such a significant change, correct?
Yes. The thing, those graphs, they speak for themselves, because if you looked in the 1960s and 70s, you didn't see any of this stuff. I mean, it was there, but it wasn't that common. And even if you say, okay, we're better at it, actually, if you look at the real rates, they have increased, and everybody says this. So Parkinson's, you're not going to miss Parkinson's, and Parkinson's has gone up. You're not going to be, and you know, what's my favorite graph is the one of diabetes, because in the 1960s or so, 50s, the rates were high. People died from this disease. They didn't have very good treatments. And so from 1950 to about 1980, the rates plummeted. They just really fell to the ground. And, you know, being a healthcare person, it's always nice to say, you see what we've done? We're so good. We really cured. We have a good grip on this disease. We're great, man. This is wonderful, you know? And then you see exactly the opposite trend taking place, and paralleling the rates of Alzheimer's disease over the next 30 years. And you say, oops. So aren't our drugs better today? Aren't we better doctors today than we were? Why are the rates so high? And why are they paralleling Alzheimer's? And why are they paralleling all these metabolic syndromes? Wow. And, you know, when you put them all together, you have metabolic syndrome, you have fatty liver disease, you have obesity, you have diabetes, and they're all with the same trends. So then you say, oh, wait a minute, something's wrong because this is crazy. All of them are showing exactly the same thing, and all of them have insulin resistance. They all have a problem with energy metabolism and taking up the fuel in an efficient way.
Wow. So going back then to the insulin resistance, and if we're saying, or if you're saying that the brain cells basically are not being able to get enough glucose because of the insulin resistance, what other alternative is there out there for the brain cells to get what they need?
Well, I think it's better to understand the fact that if they're not taking up the glucose, the alternative is to use these things like ketone bodies, but that happens in states of starvation. An important thing is to realize is that people's brains, although insulin comes from the periphery, meaning it comes from the pancreas, the insulin, there's also some made in the brain. And there's a separation. It's almost as though all these gut hormones, and they're all there in the brain, they keep the brain functioning by itself. So you can see people who have no body function. They're totally paralyzed. They don't do anything. But they can talk and they can interact and everything, showing you there's a separation between brain and body for a lot of things. And if you think about it, it's its own microenvironment. I think you can do a lot of things. I mean, so you say, what is the thing? You have insulin, you have the uptake of glucose and metabolism and making ATP, which is basically, it's like gasoline in the brain, it's the fuel. But there's also another problem in that, like all examples of diabetes, the blood vessels need the insulin too. And the blood vessels eventually in the brain become very thick and scarred. And so even if you could supply the blood and the nutrients, the glucose is coming from the body, if the blood vessels at the very, very ends of the road are so small that you can't even get blood cells through efficiently, you have a second problem, which is the poor blood flow to feed the brain. And so if you don't have the glucose going in properly, and now you also have the inability to take it up, you're starving it from two fronts.
So how about the concept of getting some of that energy from the medium chain fatty acids?
So, of course, you can, when you eat fats and you break them down, you create smaller molecules called fatty acids, and those are taken up by the brain. Those are excellent sources of fuel. And the question is, what's the efficiency for uptake? You know, I don't know if people know, but half the brain is lipid, meaning fat. And so when you're making what's called myelin, which is basically the stuff, let me just try to translate that. So neurons are basically cells. They are cells. And they talk to one another by sending out long tentacles like arms, and they have to reach each other. Well, if you can imagine a naked arm in the cold, it doesn't work that well. But if you put some insulation around it, you can move the arms better. The same is true in the brain. If you put insulation around it, then the neuron A can talk to neuron B much more efficiently. And that insulation is called myelin. Myelin is made up of fats, and the fats that you eat the basic building blocks are used. And one of the things that goes on in terms of myelin in Alzheimer's is that it does degenerate. And so the idea that you can replenish this part of the problem by providing the right basic nutrients is a good one. There's very little attention paid to this white matter or myelin abnormality. That's one of the things we're working on very intensively, because the D vitamins, for example, and the fatty acids and these things are really helpful. I don't think there have been clinical studies to show their efficacy yet. But the thing is that one has to be aware that certainly some of these other forms of energy are proving to be very effective in terms of being able to be supplied to the brain. So right now coconut oil is hot. Everybody's eating all the vegetable oils. I'm going to eat them myself.
Yummy too.
And I think that certainly, it's kind of ironic that we've gone from low-fat diet to realizing how much damage we've done with that tail. And now we're back to eating where people are recognizing that you must eat the fats and the fatty acids, and they should be largely plant-based, but still you can't exclude them from the diet, and you could actually be harming the brain by not having them. So I think that's been a good realization, and the study after study after study is confirming that. So yes, medium chain fatty acids are very good for the brain.
Thank you so much for joining us today here on Lifestyle Improvement for part one of our interview with Dr. Suzanne Delamonte, an associate professor of pathology and medicine at Brown University, and the doctor who coined the term type 3 diabetes in reference to Alzheimer's disease.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and is not to be interpreted as medical advice.
If you would like to advertise with us, please give us a call at 877-957-7387, extension 101. That again is 877-957-7387, extension 101. Or send us an email to producer@lifestyleimprovement.com. That again is producer@lifestyleimprovement.com. And don't forget to tune in again next Sunday morning at 7:30 for part two of our interview with Dr. Suzanne Delamonte.